Thank you, Brother Zimmerman. It's a real joy to share this time with you and do a little reflecting on people. Amen. We're indebted to Dr. Hurst for adding a new chapter to the medical journals. Muscle in the brain. It has been our privilege these days, with the kind permission of the Division of Foreign Missions, to entertain Brother and Sister O. Bing Ki in our home. I wanted just to say momentarily that this wonderful young couple have been such a blessing to our lives and to the work of God in that part of the world. I remember more than 20 years ago when, as young people, they were baptized in the seaside in a little island city of Penang. And after being baptized, neither of them could return to their own homes. Their parents, being non-Christians, Buddhists, refused to permit them to come home again. And for many days, they were without a home. But God has laid His hand so marvelously upon their lives, and they have been so wonderfully fruitful in the work of God. It's a delight to have them here with us, and particularly to have them in our home. I would like to say in the beginning of this presentation this morning, by way of a kind of subject, that Jesus has not lost the human touch. Jesus has not lost the human touch. A secondary kind of subject that might appeal to some of us might be how to wash feet without losing your crown. And friends, that takes some act of balancing. Hebrews 4, 15 and 16. For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. There are two very vivid experiences that come to mind as related to my early years of ministry. One, as a young evangelist preaching a revival meeting in a small church. At the close of the second week, the meeting had gone well. The attendance had not been too bad for a young evangelist. But the break had not come, and you evangelists and pastors, all of you will understand what I mean. Folks had sat in their seats. They had held to the back of the pew in front. The altar call would be given. No one would come, and there was such a sense of frustration. I remember going back to my room as a single young man and feeling that utter sense of frustration. What can I do? Is there anything that I can do to help these people turn loose and surrender their hearts so that this revival meeting can have the spiritual breakthrough that we wanted to have? The next morning, I walked over to the office of our district superintendent. He was very busy. I knew he was busy. I also knew that I needed help. I walked into his office feeling that perhaps I might gain an appointment. I might be able to see him just by pressure of need. To my utter amazement, he moved aside perhaps things that were of greater consequence to him at that moment. Listen to my frustration, called into his office the other members of the district leadership who were present, and very gently and very kindly said, "Here is a young minister who needs our prayers." And they joined that morning and prayed for a little evangelist who was trying to find his way in the work of God, lifted my spirits, and while I don't think the meeting got too much better, I surely got better. And it wasn't long before there was a real spiritual move happening. I've been eternally grateful for that time busy leaders had for a young preacher who needed a word of encouragement and who needed their concern in prayer. Thank God for them. Just before Sister Gwines and I went overseas, we were privileged to be in a camp meeting and pitched our tent in that particular camp meeting just adjacent to another of our very wonderful leaders in the Assemblies of God. It was the privilege of my wife and I to share their cook stove at that camp meeting. They had an old wood stove that stood between the two tents. This was real camping, friends. That was between the two tents, and so we cooked when they weren't, and they cooked when we weren't cooking, and sometimes we got the beans all mixed up, and it didn't really matter anyway. That experience has been most vivid in my mind, for during those days of casual camp meeting time, a wonderful leader who had many things to say to a young man who needed to hear many things, he took time, as though, even though he was the speaker in the camp meeting twice a day, there were times of that period when he would take time, I'm sure, very determinedly to talk with me and chat about my future and say a few words of encouragement, give a little advice, and just by taking time to help me and equip me to thrust myself into a new ministry. Jesus, the Son of the Most High, cultivated the human earthy touch. The marvel of the incarnation lingers with us today, and as we think of this Christmas season, the Word made touchable. A babe in Bethlehem, a child in Jerusalem, a carpenter in Nazareth, tasted humanity in every dimension. And it was John that felt this closeness in that human relationship with Jesus so that he could say, our hands were able to handle that manifestation of eternal truth. What a wonderful experience John had to be able to touch eternal truth in a physical way and to be touched by it. And he carried with him through the days of his reporting and the days of his ministry that wonderful experience when Jesus allowed him at the dinner hour to place his head upon his bosom. Oh, what a miracle that was to John, that Jesus, the Son of the living God, could give him the time of day or the time of evening and draw close enough to him that he could put his head upon his bosom and touch the Word made flesh. The truth of the matter is, friends, Jesus likes people. The likes of you and me, even. Jesus likes people. He made them and then he wanted to come down and be with them. Isn't that wonderful? In the cool of the evening, the Son of God would come and walk with his creation. He liked them. Gilbert Hyde said, if you're going to teach people, you've got to like them. If you're going to lead people, you've got to like them. You've got to know them. But especially, you've got to like them. Jesus said, if two of you ever get together and just invite me, I'll come. In my name, if you're together, I'm going to be there. I like people. He said, behold, I'm knocking at the door. All you have to do is open the door. I'll come in and have lunch with you. I like you. I like you. I like to be with you. Don't feel it's an imposition on Jesus to invite him. He wants to come. He said, I go to prepare a place for you, and I'm going to come and take you with me. I want you to be with me. His trip to earth was not just a brief excursion in which he came to earth, did his thing, went back to heaven to get out of the mess. He came, he made a plan, he accomplished his purpose. He's going to take us to be with him. He likes us. Isn't that wonderful? Amen. Jesus likes me. Oh, hallelujah. Amen. He said to his father, I want them to be with me. That wonderful prayer, Jesus said, I want mine to be with me. I don't want to be up here and them down there. I want mine to come and be with me. Oh, hallelujah. Jesus has time for us. During his busy earthly ministry of preaching and teaching, healing and all the other things, Jesus always had time for people. In a very personal, human, earthy kind of way, Jesus had time for people. He had time to attend a wedding in Cana and bless the most human of all events. I don't know how spiritual folk can get about a wedding. I'm sure there can be wonderful spiritual things about a wedding, but it's the most human of all events. Jesus came and blessed it with his presence and blessed it with his miracle. This young couple of Galilee never forgot it. We don't know who they were, but never forget, friends, they remembered Jesus came to their wedding. Jesus blessed their wedding. He had time for human things. I remember as a student in Bible college, my wife and I, not my wife then, decided it was a good thing to get married. And so we planned our wedding on Easter morning. I'm not sure why, but we kind of liked the idea of getting married on Easter morning, and so we did. Early that morning, kind of a fresh, brisk, clear, beautiful morning as I remember it. Eleanor may remember it as a cloudy, dark kind of one, but my memory is one of a brisk, beautiful morning. We didn't have many guests. We couldn't afford invitations. We had Easter lilies for flowers, some of which we had arranged and some of which the florist decided they'd use them once in the Easter sunrise service. No need to waste them, so bring them to our wedding, which was all right with us. But attending that early morning wedding was the dean of our theology division at our Bible school. He put off a trip someplace else in order to be at that early morning wedding. He brought a little gift, not an expensive one as I remember it, but he came, he was present. It meant sacrifice of personal desires. I shall never forget the fact that he came. My Greek lessons took on a new meaning. I'm sorry to say, it didn't help too much, but at least it made them more interesting. The theology lessons took on a new dimension because this important man, a significant man to me, would take time out of his personal interest to come and be in a simple little ceremony in a home where I and my dear wife was being married. What a blessing it was. Jesus found time to go out of his way and sit by Jacob's well and talk to a despised Samaritan and a woman at that. In his day, he had the time to talk about many things. It was meal time. Others were hungry. Maybe he was hungry. He was certainly tired and thirsty. But he had the time to talk to someone who needed to hear him and who needed to say something to him. She needed an opportunity to say something to someone who mattered. And Jesus gave her that opportunity. He found time to wait out the murderous emotional tide of a mob so as to, in the terms of a modern psychologist, to confirm the personhood of a woman of the streets taken in adultery. I've often wondered why it was that Jesus knelt there and wrote in the sand. It suddenly occurred to me one day that in all probability this woman was at ground level. She had been thrust there by the mob that would stone her to death. And Jesus was literally coming down to her level. He stayed down there at ground level until the mob dispersed. And then he made this woman to understand that she was somebody important. Even though her life was mixed up and confused and full of all kinds of evil things, she was an important person, and he could come to her level, and he could confirm her as a human being, as a person of great worth and great value. Now, dear friends, if Jesus could come that far down to confirm the personhood of a woman of the street, there is no person in your relationship and mine that we cannot make time for, and to whose level we cannot come to. Jesus had time at a most significant moment in his life to robe himself in a towel, to bow low enough to wash all of the disciples' feet. He did not have to abdicate his throne to do it. He did not lose his crown in bowing so low. He was able to come down and do the human thing at its lowest level and make those to whom he ministered feel that they were of worth and they were of value. One of the most amazing things to me is that on the night that Jesus was betrayed and was being tried in that infamous hour, after Peter had denied him already three times, early in the morning, Jesus had been beaten, his brow was already bleeding, his back was bruised, his beard had been plucked, he had been spat upon, suffering untold physical agonies, no doubt. And yet, when the rooster crowed, suddenly he remembered. Suddenly he was aware that somebody needed a look. And so he turned and he looked across the courtyard to where Peter was all slumped down because he had failed so miserably. And Peter turned his eyes and caught the eye of Jesus in that one beautiful moment. In that one marvelous moment when Jesus could and should have been so totally consumed with his own interests and his own hurts, if you please, he could turn his eye and catch the eye of a suffering, failing, hurting, miserable disciple who had betrayed him and cursed. Yet he could look, and in the distance between him and Peter, he could catch his eye and give him that most significant moment that undoubtedly meant the healing of the broken heart of a wayward disciple. He found the time in his dying hour to comfort his mother. And more than that, he found the time to answer the prayer of a murderer and a thief. He found time in a moment so filled with personal anguish, lips broken and parched, side bleeding, hands bleeding, back bleeding, bones out of joint, thirsty. And yet he could hear the prayer of a suffering, hurting, wicked, filthy man and answer that prayer and respond to his faith. Today thou shalt be with me in paradise. After his resurrection, Jesus could hold still the hands of the clock of divine purpose, if you please. This is an interesting thing to me. I don't understand eternity. We only understand time and getting caught in the trap. We understand that. Eternity, we do not understand. But Jesus somehow could hold still the hands on the clock of divine purpose when he knew that there was a dear woman so frustrated because she felt she had lost the only true friend she had ever had, lingering there at the door to the tomb, weeping out the anguish of her spirit, because the only one that had ever blessed her life and ever helped her was gone, and she could not even find his body. And Jesus turned aside from his trip back somehow into the presence of his Father. He took time out in divine purpose, if you please, to come by once again and just to say the name, just the name, Mary. If it had been I would have said, I would like to help that lady if only I could remember her name. Which is more truth, friend, than I care to admit. But Jesus knew her name just like he knows your name and he knows mine. He knows my fingerprint and he knows your fingerprint. There is not a sheep in his pasture whose name he does not know, whose name is not written on the palm of his hand, whose name he does not remember. And in the hour of our need, if necessary, and it's not necessary, but if necessary, the hands of eternal purpose will stand still while Jesus comes to say your name and mine, if it will help us. Go tell my disciples and Peter, he said. He took the time to say Peter's name. And Peter. Be sure you include Peter. He needs to know that I want him there. He took the time to gently draw the trembling fingers of an unbelieving Thomas and put them in the soft scars of the wounds of his side and his hands and his head, so that a doubting man, honest in his unbelief, could find the grounds for faith. Jesus was able to take hold of his hand and draw that hand into the wounds of his own side. In his resurrected body, he would take fish and bread and he would eat it in the presence of his disciples to prove to them his continuing affinity with humanity. He was not, because he had died and resurrected and was glorified, he was not disconnecting himself with humanity. He was continuing his affinity with humanity, and he proved it by eating with them, even in his glorified body. And he would stand by the seaside and face the frustrated disciples again, and there he would cook breakfast for them. There he would break the bread and the fish with them, and he would sit upon the sands of that Galilee seashore, and he would talk about fish and sheep. He would talk about love and death. And in that moment of human intimacy with those whom he liked and those whom he loved, in that moment of human intimacy, he would snip and cut forever the cords of the old life and set these disciples free to be the apostles that he had chosen them to be. Just by his presence, just by the time that the busy Christ could find for them, he could release their spirits and release their lives that they might grow and become that which was his design for them to become. He sought from the beginning to establish the human dimension in the ministry of his apostles. It was at the first visit to Gennesaret with his, in those early years in Luke 5, that he said after the miracle of the draught of fishes, he said to his disciples, "Don't be afraid, from here on you'll catch men." It's men that we're concerned about, not fish. 3 years later in Tiberias, 7 miles south, after his resurrection, once again, Jesus would bring them back to this great truth. "Do you love me more than all these things?" The New English Bible puts it in that translation. More than all these fish, more than all these human things, more than the smell of the salt air, more than the freedom of the sea, Oh, friends, when you're talking to a fisherman, never talk about fish stinking. Fish don't stink to fishermen. I was down in Louisiana not too long ago at preaching in one of the cities where there's a paper mill close by, and I was complaining. The pastor said, please don't complain, friend. Friend, the folks here don't complain. He said, they like it. They like it because it gives them work and makes salaries possible. Jesus said, do you love me more than all of these things? Going fishing, your old way of life, the call of the sea, the excitement of the catch, the smell of salt in the air. Yes, Lord, I love you. Then nurture my lambs. Shepherd my flock. Feed my sheep. Now, we've had one lesson from the farm this morning. But let me give you another, or just suggest to you another, that feeding sheep is hard work for fishermen. If you think fish smell bad, you should just put fishermen in a cow lot. Feeding sheep for fishermen means a total shift of life's values. If you love me, turn it over. Leave the smell of the salt in the air. Leave the thrill of the big catch. Nurture my lambs. Take time for my flock. Feed and shepherd my flock and feed my sheep. And let me tell you something, dear friends, and you know it. I'm telling you nothing this morning that you do not know. Do you know, if necessary, God will spend 40 years teaching a man how to feed sheep? Take a man that he has chosen and thrust him into the desert, if necessary, to cause him to understand and to learn what it means to walk patiently with sheep, to learn meekness and gentleness and patience, not only with his own flock, but with another man's flock. And God so emphasized this truth in the life of Moses that just one violation in the life and ministry of Moses, in which he became impatient with God's flock, just one time that he stood on the mount and became impatient with God's people, cost him the land of Canaan. That's what we're told. One time when Moses blew his stack with God's people, cost him the land of Canaan. Now, I know there are many other implications of that. I'm not wanting to suggest that if you have slipped a little in this way, that you've lost it. Because if that be the truth, we've all lost it. But God, in setting for us a great example in the life of Moses, certainly left us that great truth. These are not our people. The people whom we lead are not ours. We did not die for them. We did not shed our blood for them. We did not redeem them. They are the people of his flock, of his fold. And he has set us as under shepherds. And he expects us to walk gently among them. He expects us to nurture them. He expects us to have time for his people. There are three significant factors that we should recognize in taking time for people, and I will move through these quickly. First of all, time for people is an attitude of life and ministry, not just a calendar of daily duties. I don't want to say not a calendar of daily duties, because scheduling is very important, and sometimes in order to have the right kind of time for people, it means keeping a proper calendar. But it's more than that. It's an attitude of life and ministry. Jesus illustrated this most vividly in his story of the man on the road to Jericho. And the religious people were too busy to pay much attention to him, but a secular humanist, if you please, and we dislike the term. We don't believe in humanism per se. We dislike the idea of the humanistic concept in any wise infringing upon spiritual things, and this is right. But it was necessary for Jesus to draw an illustration from the most unlikely situation to help us to understand the value he places upon some things. And so Jesus would illustrate the good neighbor policy by a secular Samaritan traveling on the road to or from Jericho, who could manifest such ardent concern for his fellow man. Nothing is said of this man's spirituality. Nothing is said about the level of spiritual attainment. He was only exercising good neighborliness. He was taking time for people in need because somehow ingrained in his human nature there was this feeling for the man that was down and out and needing help. Of all people who ought to have a heart for people, those who know God best should have a heart for people. And to add to that humanistic concern the values and the dimensions of eternity, what a tremendous opportunity we have. Jesus would not allow his disciples, even in the most sublime spiritual experience, to become insensitive to human need. And so he took them down from the Mount of the Transfiguration right into the valley where they must feel the pressure and make time for people who were hurting. The quality of time is more important than the quantity of time given. Proverbs said a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in pitchers of silver. A young man was burdened down. I know this young man personally. He was burdened down with some heavy responsibilities that others did not understand. His mind was somewhat confused. He felt perhaps that he was being asked to do more than he could do. He didn't know how he was going to get it done until one day, walking down the hallway, a man of great significance in the life of this young man put his arm around his shoulder and said to him, "We understand the pressure you're working under. We would like to help if we can. But regardless, we understand. We understand." And the young man went on his way, finding a means to carry his burden because his spirit had been lifted. A word fitly spoken. How important it was in that simple moment that Jesus stood before his accusers and Peter was slinking away in the sense of self-degradation and defeat. How important in that exact moment that Jesus should look and catch his eye. Any other time, it would have been misfire. But right then to catch the eye of Jesus was exactly the right moment. A word fitly spoken, a look, a pat on the back, a little time given at the right time can often be far more important than a great amount of time given. The third thing is motivation eventually will shine through in your making time for people. Why you do it will sooner or later become apparent. I haven't time to develop this. There are many things I would like to say about it. But in leadership roles, I think we have to be very careful that we do not either subconsciously or consciously manipulate people. We have to be very careful that we're always thinking in terms of their interest or the interest of things that are greater than both themselves and ourselves. We have to be very careful that we do not become manipulators of people. And modern psychology has taught us how to do it with great skill. Let me just conclude by just an illustration from the book of Acts again. Jesus has not lost the human touch. In his glory, he has not lost the human touch. In the 8th chapter of the book of Acts, when one of his disciples, one of his apostles, was right in the thick of it. I mean, it was give and take. Stephen was giving and he was taking. And the multitude around him was angry with him, and the crowds were gnashing upon him with their teeth, ready to stone him to death, and he was soon to be on his way. But as they would grab him by his arm and lead him out of that meeting place that day, suddenly Stephen looked up, and he caught a vision that restored his soul. I don't know what Stephen was feeling before, but I know what he was feeling afterward. Because when he looked up, he saw that Jesus was standing on the right hand of his Father. Standing up, which is not exactly the way that Jesus is described as occupying eternity. But there he was, standing up, cheering, I think, without giving any kind of indignity to Jesus in his glory. But I think he must have been cheering just a little bit. And the reason I think so is because a few years ago, well, more than I like to remember, but a little girl in our family out in Malaysia, their school was having races. And of course, I went down to watch the races, and when one of my kids is involved in any kind of activity, I'm also involved. That's about the way it is. But I remember when this little girl, only 5 years old, was running the race that day, and she won. She was the happiest little girl I'd ever seen, and she had the happiest little father that there could have been. Such a sense of exultation. She had won. She was winning. She was coming through. And I think that Jesus, in that great, wonderful sense of human touch that he had when he saw Stephen coming through, he just couldn't sit there any longer. He stood up to cheer. Stephen is winning. Just before his crucifixion, Jesus, with his disciples, he girded himself with a towel and washed their feet. The scriptures tell us in Luke chapter 12 and verse 37, "Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you that he shall gird himself and make them to sit down to eat, and he will come forth and serve them." Now, friends, let me tell you something, and let me tell myself something. Jesus has not, will not lose the human touch. Out yonder in the glory, with the crown upon his head and robes of royalty around his glorified body, however that will be, there will come that moment in your history and in mine and in the history of every child of God, when once again he will bid us sit, and he will gird himself with towel, and he will come forth, and he will serve, and he will minister, because he has a touch for his people. He has time for us. God bless you.